It's truly a pleasure to be here with you this morning preaching, because so many of you knew me before I was in seminary, before I even considered the call to ministry, back when I was, maybe some of you even knew me when I was a precocious four-year-old child. I think that was, I was probably up here my first time when I was 5 years old, and I think being here in this space owes a lot in so many different ways to me being a minister now. I would not be here without, if not for you, if not for this church. And those of you who have known me a long time know that I've long been passionate about anti-racism work. Anti-racism work was, of course, my number one justice issue. In fact, a major part of my call to ministry came out of the anti-racism work that I did here at this church and in our wider faith movement. But in my last few years here, I also started to get increasingly concerned about the environment. Now, I had always had a connection with the natural world. Our family would regularly go camping or backpacking or hiking. In fact, I was only 3 when I went on my first backpacking trip. Now, the hike was only 1 mile, and I didn't actually carry a backpack. In fact, my main contribution was complaining vociferously about how tired I was, only to scramble all over the rocks whenever we stopped. But from that early age, I loved being out in nature. It was a place to be renewed and to be recharged, to see creation in all of its beauty and all of its splendor. And at that time, you know, growing up, I certainly felt the necessity of protecting the natural world, of saving the rainforests and protecting our natural water sources, rescuing endangered species. But something shifted in my thinking after Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. People were talking about this not as some freak storm, but a sign of things to come with rising sea levels and more extreme weather, a more regular part of our world. And so I started to get more involved and interested in environmental issues, focusing on things like renewable energy and what we eat and how we grow it. And as I shifted more and more towards concern about the environment and the climate, part of me started to feel a little bit guilty that in my shift towards addressing climate change, I was moving away from racial justice. Now, isn't this the struggle? In a world with so much justice that demands our attention, economic inequality, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ rights, immigrant rights, political corruption, religious strife, healthcare for all, women's rights, it's hard to figure out where to focus our energy. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard someone say, well, what we really need to be talking about is class or economics, or, well, we need to focus on racial justice, or immigration, or peacekeeping, or whatever issue is most important to that particular person. One that I hear in the environmental movement is that all of these justice issues are important, but if we don't have clean water to drink or air to breathe, the rest of it doesn't matter. And there's a certain sense in that, but as time passed, I began to question the very notion that these issues had to compete with one another. Because the reality is, as I came to see, these issues are deeply, deeply intertwined. Take Hurricane Katrina, that Category 5 devastated New Orleans. But when the waters receded, what Katrina left exposed in her wake were the stark lines of racism and classism that had always divided the city. When a group of 20 or so of us from this congregation went to New Orleans to do recovery work in 2010, we saw the devastation that was still left 5 years later. Countless boarded up homes, blocks with only 2 houses remaining, most of which were in historically Black communities. The white communities tended to have a quicker recovery. So trying to pretend like the justice issues like racism and classism in the environment are not deeply connected or intersectional, to use a phrase in justice movements, not only doesn't make sense, but approaching one issue without considering the impact of other justice issues often perpetuates those injustices. Unfortunately, the environmental movement has a long history of ignoring other justice issues, protesting cutting down rainforests halfway around the world while turning a blind eye to neighboring communities of color being ripped apart by institutionalized oppression and neglect, or deriding Walmart shoppers while ignoring the underlying economic conditions which make Walmart the only place they can afford to feed and clothe their family. For some, there's a perception that environmentalism is a cause for the privileged. Because how can you care about saving polar bears, buying organic produce, and converting to renewable energy when you're worried about how you're going to get your next meal on the table? Or whether your loved one will be deported? Or what happens the next time a cop decides to pull you over? And it's true that environmental activism has often allowed people to feel like they're making a positive contribution while simultaneously giving cover for ignoring the institutional racism and classism that so many of us are beneficiaries of. But thankfully, there's been a shift that I've seen happening in our justice movements, an acknowledgement of how all of these justice issues intersect. The platform that was put out by Black Lives Matter a year and a half ago, challenges the patriarchy, exploitative capitalism, militarism, and climate change. Environmental justice and racial justice groups alike showed up to support indigenous sovereignty at the Standing Rock Reservation in their fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Women's March, the largest march in our country's history, had a platform calling for ending violence, reproductive rights, LGBTQIA rights, workers' rights, civil rights, disability rights, immigrant rights, and environmental justice. We've increasingly come to realize how interdependent the planet is. Polar bears drowning because of melting sea ice is directly connected to the reality that large swaths of Bangladesh, the Philippines, and Thailand will be underwater or more vulnerable to catastrophic floods. The pesticides that are used in conventional farming have the worst health impacts on the typically underpaid and exploited migrant farm workers working in the fields. And pollution from fossil fuels, which fuels climate change, is most concentrated in our urban communities, cut through by freeways and pushed up against industrial development, like Curtis Point in Baltimore, or West Long Beach and Wilmington and Carson. That's the difference between environmentalism and environmental justice or climate justice. The recognition of our interdependence with all of creation, and a declaration that all people, regardless of race or class or nationality, have a right to be free from environmental harm. As the climate crisis continues to deepen, it means that we, the industrialized nations of the global north, have a responsibility to mitigate the harm caused by climate change and environmental degradation. Crises which we are primarily the cause of, especially those of us here in North America, and yet we will not experience the worst brunts of climate change. Some of that is due simply to geography. The places in the tropics will get hotter, drier, more droughts. But part of it also is the lack of resources those countries have. And as a 2007 report created for that liberal institution, the Department of Defense, makes clear, if those countries in the global south are not able to adapt, there will be dire consequences. The report states, economic and environmental conditions in these already fragile areas will further erode as food production declines, diseases increase, clean water becomes increasingly scarce, and populations migrate in search of resources. Weakened and failing governments with an already thin margin survival foster the conditions for internal conflict, extremism, and movement towards increased authoritarianism and radical ideologies. Sound familiar? We can see this most obviously in Syria, where the current civil war arose out of Syria's worst drought in 900 years, which forced 1.5 million immigrants to leave rural areas for cities over a five-year period and destabilized the country. And of course, Syria is only the most dramatic example, but we can see this happening in countries in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America. And because of their exploitation by northern powers through imperialism and now globalization, these countries lack the resources to adapt in the short time frame we have before things really start to get bad. And we must pay our debts to the global south, providing resources and support to help those countries adapt to the stresses that global climate change brings. It means shoring up seawalls in Manhattan and Mumbai, building higher levees in Amsterdam and Abidjan. It means preventing the privatization of dwindling water sources by Coca-Cola for our bottled water. Long Beach has great tap water. Locally, it means having green jobs training programs for economically disadvantaged youth and building community gardens in communities where most of the food comes from fast food restaurants and liquor stores. In some cases, it means cleaning up that local water, like in places like Flint, that have been indeed so tragic. It means valuing people's inherent worth and dignity as humans, as human beings, not just as laborers or consumers, mere cogs in the machine of industrialism and capitalism. Globally, it will also mean a new emphasis on peacemaking and de-escalating violence. Yet Christian Parenti, in his book Tropic of Chaos, suggests that we are taking a very different track. He writes, "Already, as climate change fuels violence in the form of crime, repression, civil unrest, war, and even state collapse in the global south, the north is responding with a new authoritarianism. The Pentagon and its European allies are actively planning a militarized adaptation which emphasizes long-term, open-ended containment of failed or failing states. Counterinsurgency forever. Just trying to keep those people contained, keep that violence off of our shores, away from our borders. Whatever it takes." This is not the vision I have for any world I want to live in. Many of us are familiar with the Martin Luther King Jr. quote that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, which I should point out is actually a paraphrase of a quote by the Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. And when I think about how the industrialized world is planning to respond to climate change through this militarized approach, I cannot help but feel this will be the single greatest case of that arc being wrenched in the opposite direction. The thought of creating such a cold and callous response is a pain ripping at my heart. But this is not just a moral imperative. This is a matter of our own survival. As Christian Parenti makes chillingly clear, this sort of climate fascism, a politics based on exclusion, segregation, and repression, is horrific and bound to fail. There must be another path. The struggling states of the global south cannot collapse without eventually taking wealthy economies down with them. If climate change is allowed to destroy whole economies and nations, no amount of walls, guns, barbed wire, armed aerial drones, or permanently deployed mercenary forces will be able to save one half of the planet from the other. For the sake of us all, I hope we can find the wisdom and compassion to ensure that whatever future we are building is for the good of all people and all of the planet, not for a select few. Now, you may be asking, with this stark reality, and indeed it is stark, what do we do with climate change deniers in the White House and Congress and EPA and a fossil fuel CEO running the State Department. It would have been hard enough had Hillary Clinton been elected. But what now? These are indeed difficult times. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt. But the good news, and I think it's important to remind ourselves of this, is that despite what our own idiotic government may be planning, the rest of the world is still taking action for the environment. When global leaders met in Marrakesh for climate talks just a few weeks after the U.S. presidential election, rather than fretting over the future and pulling out of the 2015 Paris climate agreements, other countries only strengthened their resolves to combat climate change, setting more ambitious goals, offering more money to those countries that needed it most. So there is hope. And here in the United States, as concerned Americans, we need to take action to fight for climate justice on the state level and the community level, if we cannot impact it on the federal level. And indeed, that is where most of the change has taken place and will continue to take place. That means stopping fossil fuel pipelines, refineries and incinerators, and fossil fuel export terminals in our port, which will protect poor communities and communities of color from environmental pollution, as well as combating climate change. It means increasing the supply of renewable energy and the demand for it, and growing energy efficiency programs, and doing so by providing green jobs to the economically disadvantaged, to people returning from prison, and those whose jobs in the dirty energy sector are disappearing. For this transition, whatever it is, needs to be a just one. We can't just say, sorry, your job in the coal mines is gone. Good luck. We need to create better alternatives, and indeed there is hope in the fact that the fastest growing job, I just heard this morning on the radio, the fastest growing job in the country is wind turbine technician. And it doesn't actually even take any college, just on-the-job training. What a great possibility. And it also means stepping outside of an economic system that exploits people and the planet. And there are many ways that we can do this. By supporting your own, by growing your own food, or supporting local farmers through farmers markets or CSAs. It might mean patroning worker-owned co-ops, or living in intentional community and sharing resources with one another, trying to lighten our carbon footprint. In particular, it means following the lead of people of color and frontline communities, those communities who are experiencing the worst brunts of our climate and environmental problems, those communities that have the dirty air, those factories whose land has been taken. And listening to their voice, and not coming in as the enlightened savior who's going to say, well, this is what you need. This is how you can fix your problem. It means taking that humility and a sense of knowing that these people who've been experiencing this for decades, that people on the front lines who've been struggling and fighting know what their communities need, know what their communities want, and they actually know how to fight and win. And part of that coming together and supporting those frontline communities is about building local power through organizing and action. It might be through attending the People's Climate March, which takes place in Wilmington next Saturday, less than a mile from West Long Beach, where Tesoro is planning to expand its refinery, which would make it the largest refinery on the West Coast. It means making sure that California remains one of the global leaders in climate action. Indeed, we have been and continue to be one of the leading lights, not only in the country, but in the world. But in this time in particular, our leadership and our strength is so incredibly vital. And because things will be getting more challenging with pushback from the federal government, our legislature will need all of the support and encouragement and goading and harassing that it takes to get them to make sure they stand up for our environment and make tough decisions that we need for our future. And as we have those successes, and indeed California is a state that is flourishing, other states can know and other legislators can know and see what's happening here and see how it's working and then be inspired to take action in their communities as well. There are lots of opportunities. The reality is we here, most of us here in Long Beach, we never had much of a chance to make an impact as individuals on the federal or global level. But we have always been and continue to be able to make tremendous change locally. And that change spreads up from the grassroots into real systemic change, even if it takes 4 years or hopefully less. So I invite you to answer that call. The call that those voices are calling you to, the voices of those who are oppressed, those who are experiencing the worst of the pollution in their communities, those whose countries may be underwater, the voices of the four-legged beings and the two-legged beings and the winged ones that speak to us in our own ways, the voices of generations not yet here who are calling to us to save this planet, to work for a future, to work for a world that is livable. In these difficult times, I hope you will remember those voices and what they are calling you to do. May it be so.